Accession number 20094, Reel 7.
That's the Reel 7.
Yes, and so unless you really brace yourself, unfortunately as well, we had I helped to rig some of the aerials on the Kingsmill, and was asked to leave a modicum of slack to allow for whiplash in case the ship got hit, and also to put what is known as fuse loops in the main triatic aerials. That's like you put a big loop in and you put a thinner piece of wire to hold it together, hold the loop together. So if the ship gets hit and the masts spring, the weaker bit of wire breaks, but you don't lose your aerial. It hangs down, but you don't lose your aerial. And but even those, that they were snapping under the strain of the ship was whipping about so much. After the gales have subsided, and then they started salvaging what they could, there were going to be two Mulberries, Mulberry 1 and Mulberry 2. But they salvaged what they could to make the Mulberry, the one at Arromanche, the main one. We took over as control officer because the Bellola returned to UK. She'd been damaged. She'd been hit and she'd been damaged. Most of the big ships had stopped their bombardment. It was quite uncanny to see my old ship, the Nelson, open up way down on Saw Beach area when she opened up on the bombardments about 5 days after D-Day. We were then assigned to become captain of patrols. This meant leaving the beachhead every night. Leaving the safety or the not leaving the inclines of the anchorage, which is enclosed by all these sunken ships as breakwaters and things like that, leaving that and going patrolling off Le Havre with 2, 3, maybe 4 flotillas of MTBs, MGBs. And this was to stop all the nasties that the Germans had, like two-man torpedoes, explosive motorboats and the like, from coming out from Le Havre and getting into the anchorage. One or two ships were hit by them, the Dragon, the cruiser, the Polish cruiser, ex-British, but then transferred to the Polish Navy. She was hit. And she was sunk as part of the breakwater, actually, as well, eventually. But, and we controlled them, and I took the job on, or I was, didn't take it on, I was given the job of operating the small transceiver that was mounted in the plot. And we used to operate off the plot table, the plotting table, with the control officer. He was an ex-MTB skipper. I think his name was either Hollings or Hollis. I'm not quite certain of the full name, but I know he was a DSO and a DSC in bar, and he'd seen quite a lot of action. He knew all the skippers of all the boats, of all the MTBs personally. And we used to operate from the table, and we built up quite a rapport between ourselves. He used to operate with a red chandrograph pencil, and I used to operate with a green one. He didn't want too much noise in the plot. He wanted it quiet, so therefore I had to receive all things over headphones. And anything I came through, I would jot down in a green, in my green chinograph pencil. And when he saw it and acted it, he used to wipe it off. if he wanted to signal to go, to move one group of MTBs from another position, he would just give me the call sign of the group that he wanted to go. He just put V 270 2.5, that meant he wanted to go vector 270 degrees, 2.5 miles. The call signs were changed every night, by the way. There were just two letter call signs, George Mike, George Loves. That would be the controlling ship, or George Howe, or whatever it was called. It usually began with a G. And the boats, there'd be one would be George Love 1, and there would be George Love 2, and George Love 3, or George Love 4. And then the individual boats in those would be 4-1, or 4-2, or 4-3, you know. So you could pick up one particular boat if you wanted to, just by the call sign. And we knew who they were each night, which was the MTB, MGB, and its number. And we used to say, go out every night. Usually a bit hairy sometimes, because we at one leg of our patrol line, we used to get in range of the German shore patrol, shore guns, shore artillery, and they used to be plotting by radio, they used to put a few shells near us and all the rest of that, but we used to turn round and do a bit of zigzagging on the way in. We usually had another destroyer or frigate or something as our backup. And as I say, we used to go out on these nights. Every night there was nearly always some incident or other. It was quite hectic. In actual fact, it got so that the CNC Portsmouth said, I'm not going to have a ship doing this, because all the crew were at action stations all night. Had to be, standing at action stations all night. He said, I'm going to rotate them. So they brought the King's Mill back, and they sent the Retallick out to replace it. Another, but she wasn't a command officer, I guess. She was a straightforward turbo-electric captain-class frigate. Sent her out. We got into Portsmouth. And just we were pulling in round by Spithead, there's an MTB came herring out towards us. And ship slowed, and the MTB came alongside. And I had to throw some shaving gear and a towel and what have you into an attaché case and jump on the MTB with a few others. And we were immediately whipped back by MTB to the beachhead to board HMS Retallick to carry on the patrols that night. And this happened about every... I didn't get back to Portsmouth again, but this happened about every... 5, 6, 7, sometimes 10 days. And in that course of time, I had the Retallick twice, the Torrington twice, the Rio once, and the Kingsmill twice. Well, three times all of the Kingsmill. So I used to change ships. Towards the end, actually, I was keeping I was going on watch at 7 o'clock at night when we sailed from the beachhead, netting all the ships I was controlling that night on the TCS, and I was coming off watch at 9 o'clock the next morning after being on my feet all night and exposing away. I used to go down, have something to eat, and get my head down banging until somebody woke me to go and watch again. You know, it was quite a hectic, but looking back, I enjoyed it. enjoy the, well, the old adrenaline used to flow quite a lot. Several things, there were some incidents which stick in my mind particularly. One was a rather tragic one. There's the night that the Quorn, our backup destroyer, the Hunt-class destroyer, she was sunk. That was in that August 2nd, 3rd. We'd been approaching there. In actual fact, we'd had one or two shells. We suspect the Germans had brought up one of their rail-mounted guns and to lob a few shells at us. Because we started getting a few shells landing when the spot that we didn't normally get them, like, you know, where we expected them. But it was shortly after this that I gave the signal for the ships to turn in succession, you know, to go back to reverse course, and got no reply from the Quorn. Sorry, I broadcast it. In other words, I made the signal twice and said execute, and just in case they could receive and not transmit. And when we got back, the Quorn had been sunk. Some lifebelts and were the little lights on in the water. We had five of the survivors on board us, but the MTBs came and they picked some others up as well. I don't know how many were lost altogether, but I think it's quite a lot. And she'd not been hit by a shell. She'd been hit by an explosive motorboat, a Linz. And these were like the size of the Navy skimmer motorboat. And the bow of it was packed solid with high explosive. And the idea that they used to move quite slow, to no very little noise, until they got within range, and open the throttle up, go full belt at about 30 knots or something like that, and ram into the side of the ship. Big explosion, but before it hit the ship, the crewman used to press a button and be ejected like an ejector seat. That night, the Germans made a concerted that particular night. Because the tides were right, the Germans made a concerted attack on the beachhead that night in August the 2nd and 3rd. And all I was getting all night long were the reports of the MTBs sinking these... two-man torpedoes, the Nagers. They were called, on the RT, they were called Mother and Child. Mother being the top torpedo. They're like two torpedoes, the top one and one underneath it. The top one was the Mother, and then obviously the pilot was called Father, rather than Mother. But and what it used to do, their maneuverability was not very good, and their speed, when fully loaded, it was only about 4 knots. So they had to rely on a tide, a good tide, to take them, to carry them within striking distance. Once they'd fired the torpedo, loosed it, then it could go along about, you know, 8 or 9 knots, or maybe 10, and get back if they could. But the MTB's there, and I've had it on authority. In fact, I read it years later in the Navy News that particular night. Over 50 of these small battle units, that's Linzes and were destroyed. They made a really concerted attack. Anyway, that was over there. The next one was the Kingsmill was leaving the beach end. One evening, a JU-8 JU-88 flew over there. Whether it dropped torpedoes or bombs, I don't know. Further in, I don't know. We heard no explosions, but it banked, turned to get the hell out of it, and of course it flew straight at us. As I told you, we, as soon as we set sail from that, we went to fully closed up condition. So we didn't. We only had 2 3-inch pop guns, and they weren't anti-aircraft, but we did have quite a few 20mm Oerlikons. And this thing was flying at about 50 feet straight at us, and it was a no-deflection shot. And so all the port side battery opened up. And by the time it flew, it raised sight and flew over some banking to try to get away. It was already on fire from the wing root of the one of the engines down there. It was on fire. It flew near the Corvette, the Alberni, the Canadian Corvette, the Alberni, who let out a couple of rounds with its 2-pounder pom-pom. And the aircraft soared away and crashed. You know, it was brought down. We were jubilant. We claimed a kill. Alberni came to kill, so they gave us half each. They gave us half each of that one. But anyway, we was robbed thoughts with a spell when the Alberni was sunk a few weeks later. Anyway, another one was when we were on a patrol, and there were four German patrol boats, small patrol boats. Were there. They weren't E-boats, because they weren't going fast enough. Were coming out from Le Havre, and we sent our... I was in Retlick in this one, or no, the Torrington, in the Torrington this one. And we sent our MTBs in, you know, or MGBs to go and shoot them up. And the leader there, in this office, there's a separate little office called the Y office. This was manned by a telegraphist who was a German linguist. And used to listen in on the German radio communications. Unfortunately, though he's a telegraphist, he couldn't read Morse. He was a language student. And so when any Morse came on, he just used to put the switch and put it on a loudspeaker and ask to receive it on the chart table, you see. And I always remember this because on MCW note, when you got it onto MCW, the note is a beautiful, sweet tone, and the Morse that the German operator was using, sending, was absolutely impeccable. I would love to be able to send Morse like that. It was really beautiful. Sent about quite calmly, about 18 words a minute, and he sent, "Achtung Torpedo Angriff," repeated it, "Achtung Torpedo Angriff," and in Morse, you know, and then he started calling up his charges there with the RNP there, and I think they sunk three of them, I'm not quite certain, but they... But the other one, the disastrous one, was when we were involved, because we had to send our MTBs in the next to go and see if any of the radar gear was showing above water, and that was when the Tsar, the Britomart, and the Salamander were attacked by rocket fire and typhoons, and the Tsar and the Britomart was sunk. The Salamander, a total constructive wreck, smashed up. That was off Cape Dantifer. We sent our MTBs in at night time to go right in alongside to see if there any of the superstructure above water had any sensitive material that was salvageable. Like radar, we which you can develop, do find the frequencies of and things like that. Well, when Lee Ha fell, by the way, those mice weavers were trying to sweep a channel, two trawlers marking Dan Boys, for the big ship to go and do a bombardment at Lee Havre to try and cap, you know, and they were going to do a landing to do a pincer movement to capture Lee Havre, but that landing never took place. It came now to the end of September, early October, and our job as Canada Patrols was finished. It was just taken over because the main threat of the beachhead from Lee Havre had finished, and from further up the coast, it could be taken that any patrol activity could be taking place from Portsmouth and across the channel that way. So we returned to UK, and I finished up at HMS Macedon, which is the command operations base at Bewley. From there, my long lost service documents, which went astray when we were drafted to this mythical Kingsmill way back in the February, and it turned up. Macedon put a search in and got them. And so I put in a request to take a course to become a leading stenographist. This was recommended, and I went back to Petersfield, HMS Mercury, to do the course for leading stenographist, which I passed, and passed quite well. I was rather surprised because there was such a shortage, there was a bit of a shortage of telegraphists, particularly leading telegraphists, that I wasn't drafted straight away. In fact, there were about four or five of us, you know, there. Some went, shot at Australia, drafted straight away back to barracks and to ships. And we weren't. And I wonder what the hell's happening. And just after Christmas, just about the first week in January, we were sent for, some signalmen, not very many, about four or five signalmen, but about 10 sparkers, you know. Leading tells, TOs or people who pass for leading tell and leading tells. And we were sent for and said, right, you're going on draft tomorrow. I said, where to? Oh, you'll find out. That was the answer. When are we going? Tomorrow morning, early. So, next morning, early. We did have an early breakfast. We went down to Portsmouth Town Station by lorry, and on the platform we were taken to a special train. There's a special train there, and we noticed that there were about 30 Royal Marines there as well. They're all smart, and most of them had the King's badge on the shoulder, show that they were the elite of the corps. Well, then, so we went there. Said, "Where are you off to?" I said, "Well, no, we've just been told we've got to get on a train here." So we suddenly realised we must be going to the same place. So we got on this special train. There are no other passengers on it, and we get into Waterloo. Didn't pull into a normal platform, we pulled into the platform where the mail train used to load up. I think it used to be the old days, platform 14, I think it used to be. We pulled in there. and there's several big Matador lorries, the big lorries. They were fitted out with seats inside, you know, bench type seats, canvas. Is it right? They gave us all a bag meal and a cup of tea. That was from the station there. But we noticed that there was nobody else around. There were no civilians around. The only civilians were these two women passing out cups of tea. Didn't think much of it at the time. All this came about in hindsight. And then we get in these lorries and we go across. We go to Euston Station. And we get on the platform there, and the same security arrangements were apparent there. We were as if we were being transported under escort. They were absolutely inundated with military police. We thought, well, we haven't done anything wrong. What we do? What's happening? One of the lads. He wanted to go and buy a paper, and he wasn't allowed to. He'd be, no, get back there. So we get on this another train with no other passengers, except for a contingent of RAF people. And we noticed that most of those were sergeants. They're all technicians of some sort. Sergeants, and there were one or two warrant officers and a few flight lieutenants and that. And so we get on this train, of course in wartime, as you know, all stations' names were removed, and so we didn't officially know where we were going, but we could tell by various landmarks and people who had been on the journey before that we were going roughly northwesterly. And this proved when we pulled into Vine Street station at Liverpool.
Lime Street Station,
Liverpool. And again, tight security, into the lorries, and then we finished up in Liverpool docks alongside this big merchant ship, the Franconia. We were hustled aboard, and that was it. The jetty also had armed guards on it. And military police. One of the spies was a Scouser. He said, "Can I go ashore?" He said, "I only live across the road." He said, "No way. There's no shore leave." So then we found out that the Franconia was hastily being converted into a floating headquarters ship. They cleared out the forecastle, the bosun store area in the forecastle. Completely cleared it out and cleaned it out. The port side has been turned into a WT office, and the starboard side of it is divided in the middle, and the starboard side divided into a cipher office. In there were some sparklers already there. They were from the Admiralty, putting in high-speed Morse equipment, undulators and things like that. I helped to rig some of the aerials on the foremast. We had Lieutenant Temple Richards, and a commander, Commander Dorney, who came along, and he said, "Oh yes, you're going on a very important operation. Sorry about all the hush-hush stuff," he said, "but you'll find out all about it later on." And so, eventually, we sailed. Oh, incidentally, they had two short station transmitters fitted in the third class smoking room. They couldn't get them down for the hatchways, so they cut the sides of the ship away to get them in, then built it up again afterwards. The two Marconi Swab 8s. And these had Marconi men to maintain them. Marconi engineers to look after them and maintain them. I never saw them.